Thanks for taking this meeting with me.
No problem, but I can't stress enough. I'm looking for fresh ideas, new stories, things that nobody has done before.
And have I got one for you.
All right, let's hear it.
Okay, it's called Overcoming the Monster. Basically, there's a monster menacing a village, but fortunately there's a hero in the village, but still the monster is so big and vicious, there's like no way the hero can overcome it. So right there, the audience is worried, you know, but then he does. The hero kills the monster.
You're kidding, right?
Why?
That's basically the plot of everything.
Yeah, like what?
It goes at least as far back as Beowulf.
Oh, no, no, no. This is not a wolf. It's a monster, so.
No, no, no. Beowulf is the hero. He's a guy. He kills the monster Grendel.
That's so weird because Grendel is a, you know, it's a less scary name.
We're getting off the subject here. Look, kid, your idea is not new. It's Jaws. It's The Exorcist. It's Godzilla. It's Alien. It's Dracula. It's Star Wars.
I haven't heard of any of these.
What are you, some kind of feral child? Kid, I said give me something new.
Wait, my monster is the product of incest.
Chinatown.
Who keeps reliving the same day over and over.
Groundhog Day and that Tom Cruise movie.
But the hero has a teacher who's really tough on him, but for the purpose of making him better.
Karate Kid, Officer and a Gentleman, Whiplash.
The monster wants to dance, but the father won't let him.
Billy Elliot.
That's not fair. Every idea I ever had has already been taken. I feel like I'm trapped on a spaceship with malfunctioning re-entry engines, but there's a guy offering to save me with trumpets. But should I trust him?
Gravity and the Music Man. Look, kid, you're not fooling anybody.
Today on the show, does our thirst for new ideas drive us to embrace anything novel? And now, the airbender for the last script doctor, Colin McEnroe.
Or it might have been the other way around. I might have been the script doctor for the last airbender. I know for a fact I'm not the last airbender. I was like maybe, I don't know, fourth to last airbender. I've actually never seen that movie. Anyway, today on the show, we do want to talk about this notion of novelty in culture. This is a kind of a problem that I think is probably more confined to the arts and letters than it is to the sciences, right? In the sciences, there actually are breakthroughs, although if you read Thomas Kuhn, we know that those breakthroughs often come at the end of long plateaus in which everybody is basically biting on everybody else's work, and then suddenly something really startlingly new happens. You could maybe make the argument that happens in the arts and letters, but you could also make the argument it just doesn't. It just doesn't ever happen. That everything... Well, I'll let Mark Twain say it. Actually, before I let Mark Twain say it, I won't literally let Mark Twain say it. Let me tell you who's on the show today. Christopher Booker is joining us by phone from England's West Country near the city of Bath. He's the founding editor of the British magazine Private Eye and a longtime columnist for the Sunday Telegraph. He's the author of several books, including The Seven Basic Plots, Why We Tell Stories. And I should say before I even go a step further, that for like a year or more, I've been saying to the producers here, I want to do a show about this notion that there are only seven plots. And if so, if there really only are seven plots, what are they? Blah, 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 blah. And every time I would do that, people would kind of look at the floor like, I hope he doesn't really make us do that. But then Josh Nalea, our newest producer, he wanted to do today's show, which is a little bit more that whole idea of, are we so hungry for something new, so tired of the recycling of plots and ideas and tropes and motifs that we get really excited about anything that at least seems kind of new. So we kind of combine both of those ideas into one show. Joining us from the Audubon Street Studios in New Haven, WNPR's own studios, are Brian Francis Slattery. He's an editor for the New Haven Review. He's a musician. He's a novelist. His newest book, The Family Hightower, is out right now. Gorman Bichard is sitting right near him in the Audubon Street Studio. He's a film director, screenwriter, novelist, best known for his independent feature films like Psychos in Love and Friends with Benefits and You Are Alone. A little bit later, my friend David Edelstein will be joining us to talk about this from the film critic's perspective. All right, enough introducing. Now I give you Mark Twain, who said, there's no such thing as a new idea. It is impossible. We simply take a lot of old ideas and put them into sort of a mental kaleidoscope. We give them a turn, and they make new and curious combinations. We keep on turning and making new combinations indefinitely. But they are the same old pieces of colored glass that have been in use for all the ages. So Brian Slattery, at the risk of putting an overarching cultural theory into your mouth, that sounds like something you would say. I mean, to me anyway. It sounds a little bit like one of your basic theories about culture, that if you think you have a radically new idea, chances are you just don't understand the ideas that it's based on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly happy to be on Team Twain for that one. But no, I definitely agree. I think that, like, I mean, as you know, I always go to music. And music is one of those great places where it's, you know, it's one hybrid form after another that feels very fresh when, like, you know, when the elements are recombined. And I mean, I think though that you can kind of have it both ways. I don't think it's fair to just point and say, well, hey, you know, all he did was take a bunch of old stuff and recombine it, and that's not really new. Like, I think there's some real value in that recombination. If it strikes people as new and fresh, then, you know, to some extent it is. But that said, I mean, there is always, I think, that sense of, you know, what seems new to you is, you know, somebody else has been listening to it for 1,000 years. You know, the first time you hear Chinese opera, it's new to you, but it's an ancient tradition.
But yeah, and I think Twain's with you. You know, he says we give that kaleidoscope a turn and it makes a new and curious combination. That's, in fact, I think his endorsement of that is art. Although, Gorman Bouchard, before we plunge with Christopher Booker into this whole question of seven basic plots, one thing I've heard you say, one of the advantages I have on this show is that I know quite a few of the guests fairly well. I've heard you say in the past that in movie making, plot is so structured and formalized that a lot of times, to your wife's everlasting annoyance, if you're watching a movie together on television or something, you can actually tell her within 5 minutes or so when certain pivotal moments are going to occur. Flesh that out for us.
I think it goes down to it is the same story over and over again, especially when you're talking about Hollywood features. Occasionally, an independent film will bring in something new and unique, and that's when... You know, I think I've said to you probably on Facebook, my favorite film of the year was Ida, the Polish film, because there were scenes in that film that just took me so by surprise. I did not see them coming, despite the fact that it really was an Ingmar Bergman film from 1959 that he just happened to never make. So, you know, is it, you know, is it fresh? No. But there are unique aspects to it. But the average Hollywood film, I think usually within by the end of the opening credits, I can pretty much tell you the entire plot structure.
And I mean, I'm just going to press you on that a little bit more. So in other words, within the world of screenwriting, there are terms of art about certain things that have to happen.
Yes.
And within the industry, those things have to happen within certain time intervals.
Oh, absolutely. You have to have your plot point at the end. Your plot point that gets you from the end of Act 1 into Act 2 basically has to happen at the 27-minute mark. And very honestly, if you watch a Hollywood film, usually between 26 and 28 minutes, it is there. If it isn't there, if it goes beyond to about 35 minutes, usually you've lost interest in the film. And unfortunately, that sounds extreme, but it's so true.
All right, so Gorman's talking about movies. Brian is talking about music and, by implication, the rest of culture. Christopher Booker's joining us, too. As I say, his book is called The Seven Basic Plots. This is something that – an idea that I've heard variants of it lots of times. But he, as they say, wrote the book. Christopher Booker, first of all, I mean, how literally do you mean us to take – the phrase seven basic plots? There are only seven basic plots. How absolutely do you expect us to accept that as a truth?
Colin?
Yes, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been listening to you guys with great entertainment. What I'm not saying, and I make this clear right at the... It's a book I spent 34 years writing, so I gave it a lot of thought. And what I'm trying to say is that storytelling, which is, after all, one of the things that all human beings have spent a lot of their time since time immemorial doing, imagining these sequences of events, what I'm saying is if you look very, very, very carefully in the right way, as I would say, at storytelling, what you find is that there are seven really, really underlying structures to stories which start off setting up an expectation which can be realized in a particular way until it comes to a great resolution at the end. And there are those seven shapes which you find all the way through storytelling, right from the earliest myths to the latest Hollywood film. But I'm not saying, of course, it would be quite insane to say that every story in the world can be fitted into one of those seven plots. What I'm saying is if you understand how these plots work, how these shapes work, how they catch our imagination, how from the beginning we know that something is going to have to happen before we can be satisfied. You talked about overcoming the monster. It's one of the commonest and most ancient of plots. And it's not so much that the monster is threatening this terrifying figure. Is threatening a community. It's not just a village. It can be a whole kingdom. It can be the whole universe, as in Star Wars. You know that in the end, if you're watching Star Wars, he's taken the princess captive, and you know that what's going to happen is that Luke Skywalker and his mates are going to have to slay that monster. And you know that that's the only way this story can end satisfactorily. So what I'm saying is that once you start looking at stories in this way, and the basic plots which I'm talking about are amazingly detailed in their structure, and you can find hundreds of examples from every age, what you're looking at is the language of storytelling, which will then enable you, it's the door, it's to the door to the underworld, which can see what's going on underneath, which is what fires our imagination, which has inspired thousands of individual stories. Some stories have got several of these plots going on at the same time. Lord of the Rings is one of the few stories which has all seven of the plots in. But the point is that what you're looking at is the language in which storytelling is comes up from our unconscious. The unconscious of the storyteller taps into the unconscious of the audience or the reader, and that is what enables you to see why is it that the human race, since the beginning of time, has, as one of its main preoccupations, liked to let its each individual human being has allowed. Has been entertained by, instructed by, illuminated by the pleasure of seeing a pattern unfold that they sort of unconsciously recognize. And why is it that we have this capacity to imagine things that are, have never happened or, you know, imaginary events? What purpose is this serving? What evolutionary purpose is this serving in the life of the human race? That's the basic thesis.
So, Christopher Booker, I'm going to play a game with the other two guests. You have not been prompted on this, but I'll give them your other six plots, and they can just give me their examples. So the next one on the list, Brian, you go first, is Rags to Riches. The poor protagonist acquires things such as power, wealth, and a mate before losing it all, and then maybe gaining it back upon growing as a person. Although I think there's actually sort of a variant to that. So give me your favorite Rags to Riches plot. This may be unfair to do to guests.
The Godfather.
Okay, perfect, perfect. Gorman, how about yours?
Oh, God. I would probably say Mr. Deeds Goes to Town.
Yep. For me, I think – see, I feel as though – this is that there are only really two American plots, and one of them is this one. It's essentially Citizen Kane. It's essentially The Godfather. It's The Great Gatsby, right? You go from rags to riches, but there's still some primal wound that doesn't get healed. We just tell that story over and over again, I think. All right, the next one is The Quest. The protagonist and some companions set out to acquire an important object or to get to a location. You can't use Lord of the Rings. Facing many obstacles and temptations along the way. All right, Gorman, you go first on that one.
Wow, The Quest. Leon the Professional by Luc Besson, which is my favorite action film.
All right, that was fairly recherché. How about you, Brian?
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
All right, okay.
My quest was revenge, so.
Yeah. Let's see. Voyage and Return. The protagonist goes to a strange land, and after overcoming the threats it poses to him or her, returns with nothing but experience. Brian, you have to go first.
Oh, my God. I'm trying to think of something that isn't a movie all of a sudden. Wait, come back to me.
All right, okay.
Great. Thanks.
Well, there's an epic poem, and this is basically the Odyssey, right?
Right.
So if it's the Odyssey, then it's also O Brother, Where Art Thou, which is basically the Odyssey. But anyway, so we understand what a quest movie is. Oh, that's Voyage and Return, right?
Oh, yes.
Voyage and Return. So comedy, well, we'll skip over. Everybody knows what a comedy is. Tragedy, everybody understands what a tragedy is. And then the last one on his list is Rebirth. The protagonist is a villain or otherwise unlikable character who redeems him herself over the course of the story. Okay, I have one, but I'll go first to give you guys more time to think. That basically is the plot of The Music Man, which I think is the other basic American plot, that somehow or other, the person you didn't entirely trust, you had reason not to trust, turns out somehow or other to be reborn, to be changed, and to become trustworthy, which is sort of Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is basically both Rags to Riches and Rebirth. But anyway, you guys have a Rebirth one?
Go ahead.
Oh,
it,
man.
It's so on the spot. You should have said those days.
I know. It was totally unfair as a pop quiz. Totally unfair.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I think of that plot as one of those ones that shows up in lots of things, right?
Right.
Movies and books where, like, a character who you don't, you know, who you're told not to trust turns out to be extremely trustworthy.
Right. Well, I mean,
save the day.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it doesn't have to be that they're the star.
Han Solo is essentially introduced to us.
I was going to say, like, Star Wars has like three of those.
Right.
You know?
I mean, my favorite would I'm going to use a very strange little indie film of recent years, which is probably my favorite movie of the past 5 or so years. And it would be this movie called Starlet, which was a big hit at Sundance. And it stars this young girl who's basically a porno actress. But you learn you really see the other side of her as she befriends this elderly woman and just really helps this woman, you know, get over the loss of her own daughter. So look, and it's a beautiful film.
So, Gorman, let me ask you this. When you saw that movie, did you feel I'm seeing something that speaks to me in a really new way, that this really is new and fresh to me? Or did you think, I'm seeing something that I've basically seen before, but it's being, you know, the voice of it, the coloration of it is different enough so that I'm engaged in a way that I wouldn't otherwise be?
The latter, definitely. I mean, screams indie in every way, shape, and form. As you know, something you'll read on the reviews of it are, oh, there's no ending. Well, life has no ending until you just, you know, close your eyes for the last time. You know, so that doesn't really bother me. Yeah, I mean, it was very original. It was a very original take on an old story.
And Brian, you know, as both of you guys are creators, so as you work, whether you're working in music or more likely working as a novelist, are you feeling this incredible weight of everything that has come before? Are you thinking constantly, well, I'm not telling The Family Hightower, it's kind of a little bit The Godfather, it's kind of a little bit The Great Gatsby, it's kind of or can you simply tell yourself, I'm not, we talked about this a little bit last time you were on, I'm not going to worry about that?
I think it's mostly the second one, but with a real sense of, I'm aware that I'm pulling from X, Y, Z, and Q, and that just doesn't bother me all that much. You know, like, I figured out at one point that it's better just to cite your sources, you know, and to sort of flag to people that, you know, in case this reminds you of The Godfather, you're right. You know, if this reminds you of this, you know, you're right again. That's good. You know, good reading, everybody. and now let's proceed, because we're allowed to then take these elements and riff off of them and hopefully come up with something that, you know, still seems new and exciting to you.
Colin, when I did my last rock doc, I specifically was set out to make a rock and roll version of Errol Morris's Fog of War, because no one had done that in the rock and roll genre.
I can't believe nobody's done that before. It's such an obvious idea.
Yes, I know. And I wanted to just basically have one voice through the entire film and let someone take us through his life. And that was very much my inspiration for that.
So, Christopher Booker, there must be a certain amount of pushback that you encounter writing a book like The Seven Basic Plots, Why We Tell Stories. Obviously, it's a salute to, a celebration of, and an embrace of the human storytelling impulse, the narrative impulse that goes back to our days sitting around the campfire. But there are some people, possibly even critics, who might read that as kind of a reductionist argument, that, you know, if that's all art amounts to, it's just a saying over and over again of these seven basic structures, that's a rather puny assessment of what creativity is. Did you get that pushback, first of all?
Yeah, of course. But the great thing about what marks out the great storytellers is that they can tell a basic plot story, but they each time they do it in a brilliantly fresh individual way. And you don't have to be sitting there thinking, oh, this is a voyage and return story, I know how it ends. What you think is a wonderfully entertaining story, and at the end of it, you say, yeah, that was a really good version of the Voyage and Return story. It was a really brilliant comedy. Any of the basic plots has been, all the great stories of the world are shaped by these plots, but we're not conscious of it at the time. What we're doing, what we're seeing, is the fact that a really good storyteller, whoever it is, a movie maker or whatever, is using an underlying structure to dress it up in entirely new clothes, and that's what grabs us. So it's really just a matter of standing back and saying, yes, well, what's really going on here? What's the storyteller doing? Why are we the audience? Why do we respond to it in the way we do? And it actually shows up some of the greatest storytellers in a new light. I mean, Shakespeare was every time Shakespeare wrote a play, It was on a basic plot. Usually, it was a comedy or it was a tragedy. But the fact is that each of his plays has its own completely individual language and style, and you're gripped by it because deep down there's something going on in your deeper unconscious mind, which responds to the pattern that's unfolding. But you don't think this is reductionism. On the contrary, it liberates us to see why great storytellers are what they are. They're towering figures in the whole history of the human race.
It just seems as though, and Brian, I'll let you start out on this one. It just seems, though, that I mean, everything that Christopher is saying right now seems absolutely true, and yet it somehow or other smashes up against the idea of what we have, the idea we have of what creativity is or what it feels like, right? The idea of the creative spark is, I am going to make something nobody's ever seen before. I am going to do something, you know, that will shock the world. and I mean, it just seems like that's really are creative people essentially deluding themselves so that they can keep going.
No, that's a great question. I mean, I think that there's certainly a group of people I think who, you know, especially, you know, when they first start out thinking, you know, I want to have a sort of statement to make. I mean, there's certainly people who have taken, who have, you know, sussed out those seven basic plots and make it their mission to sort of tear them apart, right? Like, I mean, I think of like Kafka as a great example of, I'm going to set up one of these stories and then make sure that it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Like, whatever it is that you're expecting, I'm going to make it take this left turn and it's going to go off into this thing. And, you know, on one hand, you would say, you know, that's great, you've exploded this storytelling form. But on the other hand, it, you know, you could also make the argument that that's just another version of that same story, you know, and playing with the same set of expectations, you know, and it's also what makes them very satisfying, you know. And then, I can see how, and I think when I'm now the ripe old age of 40, but I remember being a younger, angrier person and having that same sense of like, you know, there's got to be something new to do out there. And then feeling this sort of sense of liberation of not being particularly worried about that, and just sort of doing your thing and sort of acknowledging the giant series of shoulders that you're standing on.
I think you can see the most obvious place where you can see where the other impulse play itself out, that impulse of somehow or other rejecting those shoulders and trying to do something new, is in the fine arts. Just walk through a museum in chronological order. Really,
yeah,
at a
absolutely.
Certain point, the reason that there is a Barnett Newman or a Cy Twombly or a Motherwell or whatever, and then from there on to Saul LeWitt and Carl Andre and conceptual artists, is that artists did essentially say, you know what? I really do have to try to do something that isn't the last guy's thing. And in some ways, that's the complaint people wind up having.
Go ahead. I think there's also a way that, I mean, especially in the last few years, people have sort of, you know, I think, but this has probably been true all the time now that I think about it. But there's always that sense of like, yeah, well, these stories have been around forever, but what does it mean to us now? And I think that like that sort of question of like, what does it mean in our modern context is what constantly makes, you know, these older ideas ready for refreshment.
Which is why House of Cards is essentially Richard III. Let me take a call from Michael in Cheshire. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Colin. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to say that it seems maybe just a little bit in the conversation we're sort of conflating novelty in terms of thematics and novelty in terms of style. Because although I would agree with the notion of, you know, seven basic plots, I think you definitely can in the arts still have novelty in the way that we people seeing things in a different way, using materials that have been around before. You know, one thing's of hip hop, for example, right? I mean, at least for me, when hip hop came out, I'd never heard anything quite like it. I mean, it may be that, you know, it's based in funk or the blues or whatever. That was a totally different way of experiencing the world. Same thing in terms of film, say like Wings of Desire. I mean, I don't know. For me, when I first saw that movie, I'd never seen anything quite like that, you know, back in 1987. You know, I once had a professor in college who said that, you know, styles change when there's something new to say in terms of perceiving the world in a different way, based on different influences that have come in. So one thinks of James Joyce with, you know, sort of a new epistemological approach and also the influence of the unconscious and, you know, combining history and Eastern philosophy, et cetera. So I think that with the way things are going today in terms of the way people communicate and blogs and, you know, using our cell phones, who the heck knows, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 years down the road, what kind of novelty that might produce.
I'm trying to decide whether I think Gorman loves Wings of Desire or hates Wings of Desire. It's one of the two. I'm going to go with hates.
Oh no, I love Wings of Desire. Oh my god!
I rolled the dice and I got
it
wrong.
Probably in my top 20.
But his point, Gorman, is I assume what keeps you going, right? And in other words, why keep making new art? Probably exactly because of what he said.
Well, in my case, what keeps me going is I really like telling stories, but I do try to find fresh takes on old genres. Like I said, when I made Everything, I knew I was basically ripping off Fog of War, but I was trying to do a rock and roll, fun, you know, completely different take, fresh take on it. When I did Color Me Obsessed, I was like, I know that there have been talking head documentaries, but they had never really been done for rock bands where you never heard any music and never saw the band, and you had everyone else tell their story. It was sort of like taking the whole, oral, you know, the oral stories that you read in books and doing the film version of it. So I think it's for me, it's always like trying to find a new take on it. But I realize that I'm still recycling all of the old versions, but trying to put them together in a different way, trying to even sometimes put puzzle pieces together that don't actually fit, but, you know, might just be interesting.
We're going to take a break. Matthew tweets to us, "I think we fetishize the new to our own detriment. I'll take the well-wrought over the never-before-done any day." We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back. "I want you, not something new," is what she said. And he lifted up his head, looked her in the eye, said, "I think I understand. For the first time in my life, that it's all been done before. And it's all been done before. Ain't it beautiful? It's all all right, we're back, and we're talking about to steal from that tweet, since nothing is new anyway, the degree to which we fetishize the new and perhaps privilege it over other kinds of things, or at least given the fact that it's so hard to create anything truly new, whether in fact things that are new draw us. Although, and I should say our guests right now are Gorman Bishard. Get on Kickstarter and check out his documentary, his plan for a documentary about Lydia Loveless. He's made many other rock documentaries as well as feature films as well and written novels. Brian Francis Slattery, musician and novelist, and Christopher Booker about to rejoin us in a second. He's the founding editor of the British magazine Private Eye and the author of The Seven Basic Plots, Why We Tell Stories. So the argument could be made that, and Brian, I'll start with you, that we really don't want new things that much, or at least when given new things, we tend to flip out. And so 1913 is the most off-sighted example. You've got for Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which not only in terms of its music, its choreography, its costumes, it just blew people's minds, but not in a good way, right? The audience went nuts. There were fist fights. You know, same year you have Schoenberg's Scandal Concert. Same kind of thing. Really, really new music. People are like going nuts and unpleasantly nuts. And around that time, too, as some of the modern as painters come forward, like Kandinsky and Klee and stuff, they do this famous Munich show, and they had to buy each other's work, basically, because nobody's buying. Work that would, you know, in aggregate now fetch $250 million on the market. They all had to buy it from one another. So, Brian, in some ways, you can make the argument, well, you know, we say we really want to, you know, we say give me something new, but we don't mean it.
I feel like I have this conversation all the time, because people will say, you know, Hollywood movies have become so formulaic and that yada, but then, you know, millions of people go see them and say that they like them, you know, all of that sort of thing. And I mean, I think that this is one of those moving targets for me. I think it's, you know, if you ask me tomorrow, I'd have a completely different answer to the question. But I think there's probably a sense of, you know, people like things to be kind of new, you know, they also want sort of a guide. And the more new things you throw at somebody, the more that they want a guide, you know, to sort of help them through it. You know, whatever that is, you know, whether it's in a book, maybe it's a character, you know, who you get to ride along with. You know, in music, it might be as simple as like, well, I recognize that drum beat, so whatever else is going on is fine because I have this drum beat to keep me down. And you know, I imagine that, you know, a successful artist is the art that seems to me to be successful is the stuff that sort of gives you a sense that there's something very fresh going on, but also some way to sort of like get into it and navigate it and then get out of it again.
So Rothko is saying, well, this is Red. You know about Red, right? You recognize Red. Red is, you know, you can cling to that anyway. You know this color. You've seen this color before.
Right.
So Gorman, insofar as, first of all, when you have dealt with the most commercial end of the movie making business, I mean, we know how those conversations go, right? I mean, everybody's interested in the last successful thing, I assume, and nobody's interested in the new thing.
Right. And it's always bringing it back to the same old thing, especially when you're dealing with Hollywood. I finally started calling them idiot notes because you take any fresh idea and you would just like dumb it down to the lowest common denominator. I mean, I honestly, having taken many, many, many meetings in Hollywood, I don't think there's a company on earth or a group of people on earth that have, you know, less regard for the intelligence of their audience.
But even then, right, sequels, eventually you've made one too many sequels, right?
When you've made your first sequel, you've made one too many sequels.
You know, and even from their own calculation, right, there's a point where even the audience who says, yes, give me another Transformers movie, says, I don't want any more Transformers movies.
They've made a Transformer movie? I wasn't aware of that.
Christopher Brooker's back with us. So Christopher Brooker, one of the things we're talking about is the notion that in fact people don't really want anything new anyway. You know, and I talked about Stravinsky's Rite of Spring and Schoenberg's Scandal Concert in 1913. But, you know, it could be anything as recent as Elvis or the Beatles, right? People, it turns out, really wanted Elvis and the Beatles. But there was part of culture that was very freaked out. They'd never seen anything like this before, that it's not necessarily wired into us to be seeking novelty.
No, I'm old enough to remember the shock of Elvis, mm-hmm. and it's one of the big moments of so many people's lives, including mine. And as for the Beatles, I mean, Beatles and Elvis were miles apart, really, but both of them were huge, great moments of exhilaration that something incredibly new and exciting was happening. I think it happens much less now. It was very exciting to live at that particular period. That's when we entered the modern world, really, back in the late 50s and the early 60s. And the mental universe most of us inhabit now, I used to think this when my kids were growing up in the 90s, they were entering a mental universe that came to birth when I was a young man. And the values were the same. The tunes changed, but the basic structures that they were finding themselves at home with and very excited by were the ones which came to birth, you know, 60 years ago, 55 years ago.
You know, Brian Slattery, one of the last times we had you on, one of the most recent times we had you on, that is, we were talking about why write a novel. Why does anybody write a novel? And I know in getting ready for the show, one of the points that you made was that at the time of Joyce, at the time of Ulysses, there was this kind of sense, all right, that's everything that can be done with a novel. This is like, not, what else could you ever possibly do? The final statement has been made. And that changes too, right? The reality is that there may only be seven plots, but there are so many different artistic forms.
Yeah, I mean, but even that's a great case to talk about, because you know, you say there are so many forms, but one of the reasons that Ulysses felt like maybe this is the end of the novel is that he seemed to have done so many of them in one book. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just that he wrote one great book; it was that he wrote one book that seemed to have, you know, 50 other great books kind of like shoehorned into it, and you know, for a couple of decades that there was a sort of general sense of, well, here's this guy who sort of, you know, dropped a huge bomb on the novel. And, you know, what do we do except kind of sort through the pieces? And, but, you know, in time that even that changed, you know, there was a famous essay that I remember, if I remember right, called The Literature of Exhaustion, that was talking about how, you know, Ulysses had kind of left not too much to do afterward. And then, you know, a couple of years later, the Latin American literature got very popular. And then there was an essay called something like The Literature of Rejuvenation about how, you know, this other group of writers a generation later has discovered a new way into the novel, you know, that even Joyce hadn't really thought of. And, you know, and then everything's back on track again.
I think, though, there are some recent examples. A visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan was a beautiful example of turning the novel slightly on its ear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although, I mean, if we parse that very much, I mean, Jennifer Egan's book, which is sort of written from multiple points of view, skipping around in time, I think we could probably, I mean, it's not jumping into the top of my head right now. I bet you we could find its antecedents pretty easily. I love that novel, but I didn't really feel like I was reading something startlingly new. Hey, we've got to grab a quick break here. When we come back, we'll be joined by critic David Edelstein. We'll be talking a little bit more specifically as we head into Oscar week about movies, and specifically also about the movie Boyhood.
Today's show was produced by Josh Nolea, a young man with special abilities growing up with people who are not his actual parents, and me, a workaholic corporate raider who falls in love with a prostitute. Our intern is Adam Blutt. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Tom Cruise. For show pages, articles, and a short video featuring the Faith Middleton Show staff as a family of kids who get a new governess who's a nun who teaches them to sing, visit WNPR.org. And now, back to Colin.
Actually, two of our guests are sitting in close proximity to the Faith Middleton Show staff right now, so they may be singing beautiful songs led by Julie Andrews. I'm not really even sure. But they're in New Haven, Gorman Bouchard, filmmaker, novelist, and screenwriter, currently raising money through Kickstarter for a documentary about Lydia Lovelace, and Brian Francis Slattery, musician, arts editor for the New Haven arts editor for the New Haven Independent and editor for the New Haven Review. His most recent novel is The Family Hightower. Joining us also is America's Greatest Living Film critic David Edelstein with CBS Sunday Morning and NPR's Fresh Air and New York Magazine. So, David Edelstein, first of all, welcome to our conversation.
Well, thank you, Colin. Can I just jump in on Wings of Desire, because I think that was a very interesting film to mention. It was mentioned a little while ago as something that seemed authentically new at the time. And I agree, it's a wonderful film. But it's a really good illustration of what you've been talking about, how nothing is quite as new as it seems. I remember that the beginning, the first half an hour of that movie, seemed very avant-garde. It was drifting around Berlin, and there were strange voices that this angel picked up. But then eventually you saw that it had a point, which was to show that society had become utterly fragmented, at which point the angel falls in love with a beautiful French aerialist and gives up his wings. And it actually turns out, despite its form, to be an incredibly conventional story. I mean, you could go back to myths of people kind of giving up, you know, supernatural beings giving up their wings and falling in love with a mortal. And here, just because it was dressed up in this seemingly formless, artful way, in the end, the audience still wanted the satisfaction of a conventional narrative arc. And what was great about that movie is it hit it completely.
So you're saying Superman was basically just an angel with a ponytail?
It's been said.
Yeah.
It's been said.
He and Lois had that conversation many times, give up the superpowers. So, you know, obviously there's quite a bit of stir. There has been quite a bit of stir in a sense right now going into Oscar weekend that Boyhood is going to take all kinds of awards. And I think
I don't know about that anymore.
Oh, really? Has the tide turned?
I think the tide has turned. I think Hollywood seems to be willing to embrace or eager to embrace Birdman.
Oh.
Yeah, well, I think the odds have shifted to Birdman.
Well,
maybe Richard Linklater is a little too outside the process. Maybe he was working in a more formless way, perhaps, than people in Hollywood were used to, making time the central character as opposed to a different kind of protagonist. Maybe they relate to the self-pity of the main character. I suspect that could be it, too.
Well, so this illustrates the exact tension that we're talking about right now. So on the one hand, there's a sense that nothing is really all that new. We're really hungry for something new. And maybe people get very excited walking out of Boyhood, feeling that they've seen, Michael Apted notwithstanding, that they've seen something that they've never seen before. And so that's really great. And we're going to embrace that. Some people would say fetishize that. And then working against that is the kind of tension that Gorman has alluded to, where, you know, sort of conventional, encrusted, calcified Hollywood says, well, actually, we don't really want to see anything that new. It actually kind of gets on our nerves. But, I mean, David, do you see Boyhood as something, and as a critic who sees so many movies, did you walk out of Boyhood saying, well, I'm excited at least on the basis that I've never seen that before?
Well, I'd never seen that before insofar as you're used to seeing characters age in a work, but you never see them actually literally age. You never see that jump. But I still thought of Boyhood as having a structured narrative for all that. The whatever Linkletter may have seemed to be making it up as he went along, but he had this idea of a father who went from an outsider, kind of a little bit of a ne'er-do-well, very shapeless life, becoming a responsible citizen, perhaps a little duller, a mother who went through all these different husbands and came out feeling as if her life had gone nowhere, and the boy having a sexual coming of age and falling in love for the first time. It's not, you know, again, it's not really that new material. What was novel was the fact that, you know, it's the story seemed to be evolving before your eyes. You had the illusion that what was happening was something that was happening in real life, and Richard Linkletter, the filmmaker, was just checking in on life as it went along. Again, so much of the art of this, you know, I took I was doing a story on Robert McKee, and many years ago I took his fabled story structure class, and it had all kinds of disclaimers in it. You know, McKee is a brilliant man, but I still came away rather depressed that, you know, he thought of commercial cinema, and most cinema nowadays is commercial cinema, even the indies. He really thought about it as sort of from the outside in. You need your initiating incident. You need to change certain values from scene to scene. You need an act structure. And, of course, a lot of people were you know, novice screenwriters who were there, but also a lot of studio executives. As has been said, you know, that a lot of them were applying Robert McKee like a cudgel to scripts that were coming in. And again, it's the art of concealment, making you think you're seeing something new, even though when it's all over, you can do an outline, quite an easy outline.
Gorman, I'm just interested in getting my favorite film, Grumpy Curmudgeon's view of, I mean, how did you feel walking out of Boyhood?
I felt after watching the screener, you mean?
Yes.
I felt that it was a little long and meandering. I basically felt that it was an idea. I think that any independent filmmaker who had seen the Michael Apted series, there are probably 500 of us who have thought, wow, that would be really cool to do as a, you know, with actors, but we could never find actors with our budgets that we knew we could trust, you know, to go along for that many years. Linkletter can. I just think it lacked a lot of structure. I found it a little bit on the meandering side. I mean, I thought it was good. It was interesting watching the kid age. But I didn't walk away from it saying this is, you know, a great movie or even one of the best movies of the year.
And let me say just a word against Michael Apted here. I mean, whose work I admire very much. But over the years, a number of his subjects have come forward and said that he is distorting somewhat their trajectory because he has a very class-based bias. And his films are making a point about the lack of mobility in British society. So there's kind of a strong narrative that he's imposed on the Up series that, once again, you're not necessarily aware of as you're watching. I understand the feeling that Boyhood, you know, may seem a little meandering. I actually think it's actually much more focused than it may first appear. Part of its art is making it seem as if it's artless.
You know, Brian Slattery, I'm wondering also, I wish I could restate Heisenberg's principle right now, but I know that it has something to do with what if you do one thing, then you lose track of the other thing. So, and I'm wondering whether that's kind of true in terms of what we're saying, that, you know, I mean, if you think about Boyhood, it's essentially what you novelists would call a Bildungsroman, right? It's a story about growing up. But because of technique, because, in fact, Linklater's using this kind of very unusual technique, maybe there isn't the kind of narrative tightness that Gorman would like to see. And I wonder if that's kind of true generally, you know, that if you're going to do something explosively different, if you're going to be John Cage, if you're going to be, I mean, pick somebody in some genre, somehow or other, you know, the impulse to be explosively different at the level of form and technique maybe takes you away from some of the narrative conventions that make either a song lyric or a movie or a painting more comfortable for the audience.
I think that, you know, whether that needs to be true, that certainly kind of does seem to be true, right? That the people who push at the edges of the form tend to also make something that strikes other people as like not as tight as it could be. I mean, there's so many examples of that, you know, in books and film and music, you know, that the people who are really struggling with the question, you know, to some extent you could describe them as kind of forgetting to do their homework, right? Like they don't do some of the basic things that people expect books and movies and music to do, you know, because their eyes on something else, you know, they're trying to get at something, you know, like a little bit different than what people are usually trying to get at. And, you know, like, I mean, Richard Linklater is kind of a good example. I mean, because I think that I was talking to someone about Boyhood this week. I've found the movie to be very sweet, you know, but the person I was talking to didn't like it very much. And, one of the things that he said was, you know, it's very difficult to relate to the character, especially the central character, who seems very kind of shapeless, you know, which is in some sense true, but I think that's true of a lot of Linklater's movies. You know, he doesn't put a lot of work into like trying to make you like his characters. He's usually doing something else.
You know, David, I'm going to let you have what will probably be the last word here. But it seems to me one of the things we're talking about also is the small group of artists in any genre who are trying to find this sweet spot. I mean, there's always an avant-garde, and that avant-garde is always pushing the boundaries and not really worrying too much about commercial success. And then there's a mainstream, you know, that is obsessed with commercial success and maybe not placing that high premium on creativity. And then there are people, I mean, you know, the Beatles came up before. The Beatles, at the height of their creativity, were working with the most avant-garde music techniques of the moment and sometimes with the most avant-garde musicians, but were wildly commercially successful. They'd brought their audience along with them. But it seems to me what we're talking about in that case, and maybe in this whole show, is a pretty rare thing. The artist who is trying to do something radically new while speaking to a mainstream audience.
Well, you have to even within the avant-garde, so to speak, there are two classes. I mean, there are some people who say that in order to break the rules, you have to master them. And that can, you know, sometimes that's true, sometimes that isn't true. Stravinsky and Schoenberg and the Beatles, who played covers in Hamburg for years, mastered the pop song before they were able to take it in new directions. On the other hand, there are some artists who maybe find their form as they work. They kind of, you know, the thing takes its own organic shape. I think that's a lot more rare that those people connect with a major audience. You're more apt to find people who have mastered the form. They know what rules they're breaking as they're breaking it. They just don't do it blindly.
All right, we have to stop there. I mean, there's like a minute left, but none of these guys is a one-minute question answerer. So I'm going to stop it there. I want to thank Josh Nalea for coming up with the idea for this show. Also, Christopher Booker, Brian Francis Slattery, currently the editor of for Arts and Culture, the New Haven Independent. Get his book, The Family Hightower. It's just like The Godfather, but totally different. Gorman Bichard, get on Kickstarter and see his project to make a documentary about Lydia Lovelace, which is not the secret name of our producer, Lydia Brown. David Edelstein is America's greatest living film critic. And he, of course, is a commentator for CBS Sunday Morning and New York Magazine and NPR's Fresh Air.
Okay, I've got it. You take the premise of Boyhood, but you reverse it. The kid gets younger. Huh? Huh?
That's the premise of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
So then we replace Brad Pitt with Gilbert Gottfried.
No.